Spiritual Warfare by Jed McKenna. Book 3 of the Enlightenment Trilogy. Copyright Wise Fool Press, 2010. All rights reserved. This book is dedicated to Ken Kesey. Truly, I have attained nothing from total enlightenment. Buddha. The Gospel of Truth. Chapter 1. Behold, I am come as thy brother and thy companion in tribulation, and I speak unto thee on this, thy day of reckoning. I walk before thee, I precede thee in thy dark night. I speak unto thee words of tribulation and woe, for I have grievously rebelled. Mine is the spirit which is neither cause nor caused, and as mine, so thine. What ailed thee, O thou sea, that thou wast driven back? Thou mountain, that thou trembled like the lamb? Thou sun, that thou fleddest from the sky? I speak unto children, that they may be made men, and unto cities, that they may yield a new man. For the cities are barren of men, and nations yield no sign. Behold, the child begotten of a child begat a child, and so the revenger, the slayer of the slayer, shall therefore arise within the border of the city, that the destroyer be destroyed, and that a new man may arise, and that the new man may be thee. Thy prophets have seen vain and foolish things for thee, and they have not discovered thine iniquity, to turn away thy captivity, but have seen for thee false burdens and causes of banishment. Rejoice! The dark night cometh, but also the morning comes. Thou shalt govern over all the earth, though there be no earth to govern. For that which was given was not given, and that which was taken is taken. Thy distress is known to me. Ye have great heaviness and continual sorrow. Thy bowels are troubled, and thy heart is turned within, and there is none to comfort thee. Nor is there congregation to praise thee, nor judge to judge thee. Thou lovest deceit more than truth, and lying rather than to speak righteousness. Thou lovest all devouring words. Truth shall likewise destroy thee forever, and shall take thee away, and pluck thee out of thy dwelling place, and root thee out of the land of the living. Behold, I am thy friend, and I am against thee, and will draw forth my sword out of his sheath, and will cut off from thee the righteous and the wicked alike. And the nation shall wail, and the city shall close its gates against thee, and I will leave thee thrown into the wilderness. Lo, thy days of filth are numbered, and thy days of controversy are numbered, and the days in the siegeless city are numbered. From the pains of the living death shall I deliver thee. From the sorrows of hell art thou promised. Only die, and I shall deal bountifully with thee. Chapter 2. Verily, thou shalt take no heed of the deceptions of the indwelling deceiver, and thou shalt stone her with stones that she die, for she and thee are one, and that one shall be slain, both be slain, Thou shalt not consent unto her, nor hearken unto her, nor shall thine eye pity her. Neither shalt thou spare nor conceal her, but thou shalt surely kill her. Thine hand shall be the first upon her to put her to death. Spare not thy sword, for she hath sinned against thee and trodden thee under foot. Verily, thy step shall leave no mark, and thy breath shall cause no stir. That which thy hand defiles shall remain pure, and that which is cleaved by thy sword shall remain whole. The wind that sweepeth away night leaveth no mark upon the day. I call you out of your city of refuge. I call you to be a murderer and be put to death. I press the poor into dust and press princes into dust, for in the dust and in the dunghill is this battle fought. Trust thou in the truth, for the wise saith that truth is righteous, and the lies of the deceiver are wicked. For lo, wickedness shall entice thee, and slothfulness casteth thee into a deep sleep. Into bread and water and flesh shall thee be drawn, but thou shalt find no favor. And it shall come to pass that the holy shall become unholy, and the favored shall become unfavored, and the familiar shall become strange. And the deceits of the serpent hath blighted thee, and thy ways are the ways of the rotted flesh, and the fallen city, and the banished king. And it shall be, when I say unto thee, Wherefore sighest thou, that thou shalt answer, For the tidings, because it cometh. And thy heart shall melt, and thy hands shall be feeble, and thy knees shall be weak as water, and thy spirit shall faint. Behold, it cometh, and shall be brought to pass. Let no man deceive you with vain words, for because of these things cometh the deceptions of the beast upon the children of darkness. Be not afraid of fear, nor of the desolation of the unjust, for the fruit of truth is in all goodness and righteousness. Awake thou that sleepest, and arise from the dead. Chapter 3. And see, and behold, even unto death, truth is thy country, nation of thy right birth, though it be foreign to thee and unknown to thee. And there shall ye remember your ways and all your doings, and wherein ye have been defiled. And ye shall loathe yourselves in your own sight for all your evils and transgressions that ye have committed. Awake, O captive exile, put on the strength, and shake thyself from the dust. Where is the fury of the oppressed? Art not thou him that hath wounded the dragon? Desolation and destruction and flame and the sword are thy path and thy way. Therefore, thou son of man, prophesy, and smite thine hands together, and let thy sword be doubled the third time, the sword of the slain. Set the point of thy sword against her gates, that her ruins be multiplied. Lo, it is made bright for the slaughter. For the adversary hath spread her hand upon thee, and afflicted thee, and now ye must rise up in thy wrath with sword and with fire. Open thy armory, and bring forth the weapons of thy indignation. Come against the indweller from the utmost border. Open her storehouses, cast her up as heaps, and destroy her utterly. Let nothing of her be left. The revenger of blood himself shall slay the slayer. Wheresoever he meeteth her, he shall slay her. So is the beast slain, and the slayer redeemed. So shall the slayer be slain, and so shall ye become the revenger of blood. Thus shalt the lamb devour the lion, and the beast shall burn upon the altar for an offering made by fire. Ye that kindle a fire, walk in the light of the fire you have kindled, and the heavens shall vanish away like smoke, and the earth shall be made waste and go forth from thee. But now, after ye have known the light, how turn ye again to the weak and beggarly elements, whereunto ye desire again to be in bondage? Stand fast, therefore, and be not entangled again in the yokes of bondage. Be as I am, for I am as ye are. Now are ye full, now are ye rich, now shall ye reign as a king over all the unpeopled earth. For we are fools for truth, but wise in truth. Verily, I say unto thee, verily, 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 life is but a dream. Chapter 1. Great Moments in Enlightenment History. When we remember we are all mad, the mysteries disappear and life stands explained. Mark Twain. How many spirituality books start with a chase scene? And how many where the enlightened guy writing the book is being chased by the cops? I mulled these questions over as I watched more squad cars arriving to join in the pursuit. A few of the patrol cars were driving slowly through the dark neighborhood streets behind me, using their spotlights to scan the houses and small yards. This was a New England vacation community in the off-season. The town had two resort hotels with marinas, restaurants, bars, pools, golf courses, and all the rest. There were a few ski hills within 20 miles, but they didn't bring in big winter crowds. Anyway, it was almost April, and it was getting warm, and they were closed now. The town had a lot of bars, and that's what the local cops mostly worried about, handling alcohol-related incidents and drunk drivers. I was close enough to hear about half of what was being said by the cops in their staging area, where the whole production had begun nearly an hour earlier. I could hear some of what they said into their radios, but not the staticky replies. There was a kind of empty urgency that had many of them confused. Urgency of any kind up here was quite a novelty. I doubt any of the local cops had ever drawn their weapons in the line of duty. They were basically a security force for the resorts and the hundreds of summer houses and estates packed along the lakes surrounding Hillside. They wouldn't find anything on me. No watch, no wallet, no money. I was just out for a walk, so I hadn't stocked my pockets. I didn't lock the house I was renting, so I wasn't carrying a key. I like renting houses and resorts during the off-season. You get the best of everything, with low prices and few people. No jet skiing or sailing, but I'm not big on recreation anyway. I've had good luck with ski communities in summer and water resorts in winter. That's what I was doing here. I had a beautiful house for the last 3 months that would have cost 8 times as much in season. Few neighbors, little traffic, not many kids or dogs, just quiet and privacy. In the sleepy town, a short and pleasant walk away, there were good restaurants that were open but not busy. I was an hour from a medium-sized college town if I needed anything the small town couldn't provide. My lease was going to expire in 2 days, at which time I would throw my stuff in a backpack and a garment bag and move on. A girl came in to clean twice a week, so I didn't even have to worry about that. So, all well and good. Nothing to complain about. Where I would go next was just a matter of whim. I had my passport and had a very interesting invitation to a place in Mexico. But I could go anywhere in the world and park for a few months. I hadn't decided yet. So that's where I was now, sitting in the dark, leaning on a tree near the town's hilltop memorial park, watching the cops bustling around in their agitated condition. They were in the parking lot where this whole thing had started, looking at maps, trying to determine who they were chasing and why. They had no answer to either question. It was a Thursday night, Friday morning, actually, around 1 a.m. I had been out for a walk, just like many other walks on many previous nights, down to the marinas, along a stretch of sandy beach, then over a fence, and a bit of wandering through the town, window shopping in the deserted streets, then up into the neighborhoods, avoiding houses where I knew dogs would start barking or motion-sensing lights would come on. Then it was downhill, back to the lake path that would take me back to my own neighborhood and the house I rented. There was a popular bar nearby, then a strip of lakeshore road with boat landings and sheds, then the parking lot and small field. As I made it through the field, I saw a couple of young guys standing on the small footbridge that connected the parking area to the lakeshore path. They were smoking a joint and got a little nervous as I approached. I waved and smiled. "Just passing through, guys," I said, and they relaxed. Then they got tense again. I turned and saw why. Two squad cars were pulling up 50 yards away, obviously coming this way.
"Shit!"
exclaimed one of the stone guys.
"Ditch it!"
The two cops were now out of their cars, trotting toward us, flashlight beams bouncing crazily around. In a flash of inspiration that is the hallmark of the enlightened master, I shrieked like a girl and ran away. It wasn't planned. It just seemed like an amusing thing to do. I really thought they'd have me within 50 steps, and that would be that. I figured I could savor the taste of freedom for about another 30 seconds before a winded and seriously unamused copper had me chewing the turf. I was just out walking. I have no record. There was nothing in my pockets or in my system. So they'd tell me what a jerk I was and let me go. If I was thinking at all, that's what I thought. It didn't work out that way, though. No one came after me. Not yet. I trotted up the cement stairs into the memorial park. I was a little disappointed to find I wasn't being chased, so I hooked back to see what was happening below. Already, a third squad car was arriving. They had the kids, and they were talking animatedly with them and pointing to the stairway I had climbed and the area from which I was watching them. Maybe they were still interested in me. I decided they were when two of them came back across the footbridge toward the stairs, flashlights out and scanning. Time to go. I got to the road and started jogging back to my house. Then I decided to get clever and to try to have some fun with it. I was curious about how serious they were about finding me. I hooked back around some hedges into a secluded driveway. There was a van backed in, so I used the bumper and a rock wall to get on top of the flat-roofed garage. I crossed that, went over a 4-foot cyclone fence, and climbed onto the side deck of another house. Everything in this area was tiered up from the lake. Two rows of houses, a narrow street, then two more rows of houses, and so on. Garages and sheds were low and flat, and trees were sparse to allow unobstructed lake views. Buildings and wood fences were all painted white, and it was a bright, moonlit night. Once I was up one street and three houses above the lake, I stopped to see what was going on. At this point, I assumed the cops were right behind me, and the fun, such as it was, would be over. I'd be completely unable to explain my juvenile antics. They might threaten me with a psych eval or something, warn me sternly, and we could all go on with our lives. Instead, I saw that the cops were still down by the lake, searching bushes and boathouses with their flashlights. They were nowhere close. Fun's over, I thought, a bit disappointed. I hadn't really meant to get away, and wasn't sure what to do with my freedom. I could walk back to my rented house in 3 minutes. Instead, I started heading back toward town on a high street that gave me a good view of all below. As I came around a bend in the road leading to a nice high vantage point, headlights were suddenly blazing in my eyes, and an amplified voice barked an order I couldn't quite make out, though I guessed it was a suggestion that I not run away. So I ran away. What can I say? The light startled me. I thought the whole thing was over, and frankly, I'd been a little bored of late. Calling upon my only superpower, gravity, I went sailing downhill into a short driveway, through a yard, over a retaining wall, along a fence, across a deck, across a street, then, getting clever, along the street, back up the hill, across another street, along hedges for several houses, up a driveway, around a house, over a low fence, through a dormant garden, across another street, and then leaned on a kid's tire swing to pant like a dog for a few minutes. I still hadn't done anything wrong, technically. I'd never heard any order to stop from a police officer. The car with the headlights ordered me to do something, I think, but I couldn't see that it was the police because of the blinding lights. I doubt anyone would be too impressed with that defense here in Mayberry on the lake, but it amused me to think I was the victim in all this. An innocent man, wrongfully accused, driven to ground and mercilessly hounded by Johnny Law. This is all going somewhere, by the way. I could hear activity, voices, cars, intermittent radio static, but I had no idea what was happening. I was very surprised that a car had been parked, lying in wait for me. I had thought the escapade was winding down, and here they were running a dragnet operation on me. I wondered how many others were involved. I didn't think the town even had 6 police cars, and probably only 2 or 3 out patrolling on a Thursday night. Had I just stumbled into the only one dispatched to find the mystery runner? Or were there more? I was still close enough to my rented house that I could cross a few streets and yards and be running a bath in 5 minutes. But that had a sort of open-endedness that didn't feel right. There was a fairly nice treehouse in the yard where I was playing ninja. I tested the nailed 2x4 ladder and climbed to the lowest platform where I was well concealed. I heard crunching gravel and saw a patrol car with its lights off slowly creeping along, windows open, watching, listening. I thought of the old throw something in the other direction to make your pursuers go the wrong way trick. But I wouldn't fall for it, and I doubted they would either. Anyway, he wasn't even using his spotlight, just creeping and listening. I knew my way around all these streets pretty well from my walks. I knew which houses had motion-sensing lights and which had good views. I was only a couple of hundred yards from a large house with some of the best views of the neighborhood, the lake, and the town from its main deck. I alit from the tree, jogged the short distance on the street, then up the main street that fed into all the neighborhood streets from the town, up to the house with the views. From the back door near the driveway, I climbed a circular metal stairway to the deck and crouched behind the railing to see what I could see. I could see one police car creeping along the streets and another parked down near where the lake path left the summer houses and ran along the pricier estates, blocking that escape route. Down near the parking area where the police had originally pulled up, I could see glints of light and metal through the trees, but nothing specific. It was around this time that the thought occurred to me, somewhat belatedly, that I had no idea what I was doing. I relaxed onto a teak lounger that was comfortable even without its cushions and pondered the silliness of my situation. I laughed and watched the stars and let a deep feeling of contentment wash over me. This is my life, I thought. I talk and write about spiritual enlightenment. I move around and live in interesting places. I run from coppers and trespass on people's decks and gaze out at a million stars. This is my life, and it's goofy and delightful and the best life anyone could ever have. I lay there for 15 minutes, maybe dozing off a bit, contented, amused. The night had been fun, a nice note to end on since I'd be leaving the area soon. I decided to walk back to the house, have a shower, and go to bed. I stood up and stretched, pleasantly chilled and eager to get home and get warm, when a spotlight hit me, wobbled a bit, and locked on. Silly people, my lulled mind thought. Don't they know we're done playing? I just want to go home now. All done. Thanks for the nice time, fellas. Apparently, they didn't know that. They thought we were still playing, and they didn't really seem too playful about it. They actually seemed kind of serious. Orders were shouted, and adult language employed. My delicate state of inner harmony was disturbed, and the chase was rejoined. I followed the deck around the side of the house, crossed a small patch of yard, scrambled up over a retaining wall and onto the highest street. Once on the road, I stopped and listened for the police car. The way it was facing, they would either have to run around or go the longer way to the ascending hairpin to get to the street where I was. Either way, they were coming up here, so I turned around and retraced my steps along the side of the house, across the deck, and down to the bottom of the circular staircase, where I was very exposed. My jacket was light tan and practically radiant in the moonlight, so I took it off and stashed it in a roadside hedgerow where I could pick it up tomorrow, should tomorrow ever come. Now I could hear radio chatter, and I could see and hear that more cars were approaching the area. I realized that some of the radios I was hearing were from patrolmen on foot. I peered through the night and was able to make out flashlight beams closer than comfort allowed. I jogged along the road, staying close to the edge of driveways and hedges. The running thing wasn't that much fun, and it wasn't part of my sensible plan, so I stopped and considered my choices. I was cut off from my house now, so the bath and bed plan was no longer an option. I could just stop playing, sit down and wait for them to arrive and hope to be in my nice warm bed before sunrise. I stood there and mulled my options, waiting for rightness to make itself known, when one of the cops on foot appeared from around a bend 60 feet away, and rightness made itself known. He didn't see me, so I tiptoed into a driveway, crept up the stairs along the side of a one-car garage, and then onto the flat, tar and pea gravel roof. There was a foot-high wall around the perimeter, so I was able to stay low and watch activity below. The cop came into view, waving his flashlight from side to side, up driveways, under bushes, up into trees. There was some more radio talk I couldn't hear, but I made out the word county and got a little worried. It occurred to me now that they were waking up local cops for this and calling in county cops. That seemed a bit much to me, but I hadn't been consulted. I liked my little garage perch, but I was clearly exposed from above and behind, so I couldn't stay. Once the cop was past, I went back down and followed along behind him. That seemed like a good idea until, not realizing he had stopped, I got too close and made a scuffing noise in the gravel. His flashlight swung toward me. He barked a command, and once again, I bolted. I crashed through a hedgerow, along the side of a house, and along a railroad tie retaining wall between houses. The copper caught me in his beam from 10 yards away. I ducked down to the next street and came out near the top of a toboggan slide, a 200-foot wooden chute for riding down and onto the lake when frozen, with a parallel stairway for walking back up. Wondering which way to go, I received inspiration from a bumper sticker on a nearby car. "What would Jesus do?" it asked, and the answer came in a flash. He'd grab a lid off a garbage can and ride it down the wooden toboggan slide to the lake and freedom. Of course, Jesus would probably have a much better medical plan than I do. Instead, I trotted back to the hilltop park to watch events unfold and decide what to do. I got there safely and settled at the base of a tree, overlooking the scene below, and caught my breath. Maybe you're thinking that the enlightened master is supposed to be a sterling example of composure and serenity, a person of exquisite poise. A person of exquisite poise and understated elegance, radiating love and compassion, exuding an air of calm and imperturbability, a transcendent being who lives untouched by the petty challenges and annoyances of daily life. That's what I was thinking, too, as I leaned up against a tree and contemplated the absurdity of my situation. "Well," I muttered, "this doesn't seem very enlightened." When I don't know what to do, I don't do anything. So that's what I did. I sat and watched, making no particular effort to conceal myself or continue the game. The whole adventure had started about an hour ago. There were 4 police vehicles down on the lot. Others came and went. County was in on it now, and I'd overheard talk of calling in state. But they clearly didn't want to let it turn into a bigger fuss without knowing who they were after or why. I was curious and a little saddened to see that the cops weren't enjoying themselves. I know myself to be ridiculously uninformed when it comes to people, but I didn't understand why they seemed so upset. It was a beautiful evening, starry, pretty moon, a bracing little chill in the air. They were out doing policey sorts of things, stalking dark streets with flashlights and guns, searching for some mysterious wrongdoer, playing with maps and microphones, organizing search patterns. A real, live manhunt. A pleasant departure from the usual grind of bar brawlers and drunk drivers. I couldn't see what wasn't nice about the whole thing. But, as I say, I don't really understand people. Anyway, they didn't seem amused. After a few minutes of watching and puzzling, I realized I'd had enough and silently asked the universe what I should do. The answer came clearly and immediately. I heard the ranking county cop decide that it was time to call the dogs. One of his men went off to radio it in. There was my answer. I had no interest in letting this thing go that far, so I got up, brushed myself off, and walked down the hill to introduce myself. "Hi, guys," I said, interrupting their map huddle. "I think I'm the guy you're looking for." Suddenly, guns. Lots of them. I was ordered to put my hands on the hood of the police cruiser nearest me. A middle-aged, overweight cop with sergeant stripes appeared to my immediate right, leveled his pistol at my head from 1 foot away, and said with trembling sincerity, "Make no mistake, motherfucker. If you move one motherfucking inch, I will blow your motherfucking head off." You don't get an offer like that every day. And here's the funny part. I didn't move. That's actually the part that I find most interesting and worth relating about this whole episode. The urge to move was certainly there. The laugh part of the urge actually made it out. But I cut off the actual motion part, somehow. I didn't laugh at the cop or the melodrama or the absurdity. I laughed because here it was, unexpectedly but quite clearly, the exit. No muss, no bother, less effort than flicking a switch. Just snap my head around and yell, "Boo!" and a deliciously amusing in would be instantly and painlessly delivered. Is this what tonight was all about? Was it time? I saw the perfection of the circumstances, and I watched as the impulse to accept the cop's generous invitation raced up from the depths and made it so near the surface that the first manifestations of it, the laugh, actually broke free. But then, curiously, inexplicably, some agent or mechanism of intercession aborted the imminent snapping around of the head that I could already feel in my shoulders. Instead, I simply said, "Okie doke." How many spiritual books start like that? Chapter 2. Timeless Time and Spaceless Space. The universe seems to me infinitely strange and foreign. At such a moment, I gaze upon it with a mixture of anguish and euphoria. Separate from the universe, as though placed at a certain distance outside it, I look and I see pictures, creatures that move in a kind of timeless time and spaceless space, emitting sounds that are a kind of language I no longer understand or even register. Eugene Ionesco. The rest of the evening and early morning were anticlimactic, but not unpleasant. No one seemed to harbor any ill will toward me, and no one treated me like the reckless dipshit you might suppose. The sergeant wasn't pleased, mainly because he had to get the city attorney out of bed so they could figure out something to charge me with. The tricky part was that, to everyone's surprise, I hadn't done anything illegal. That didn't matter. There was no way they were letting me go without charging me with something. I saw that they were having a hard time thinking up a charge, so I assured them I was leaving the area soon and wouldn't be returning for a court date. That seemed to relax them a bit. Still, I ended up spending 4 hours in the cop shop while they put it together. It was all pretty informal. Cuffs off, a light pat-down, taking some information. No fingerprinting or photographing. I didn't have my wallet, so I couldn't prove who I was, which they weren't too thrilled about. "Drive me to my house, and I'll grab my wallet," I suggested. "You're probably going to want to set a fine, so I'll need my credit cards anyway."
"We don't take credit cards," grumbled the sergeant.
"Then you'll have to run me by the ATM over on Lakeview, too," I said. Then, to make sure they didn't overtax my munificence, I added, "But my daily limit is $100. If it's more than that, I guess I'll be your guest for a while." That little fib worked, and the fine would eventually turn out to be $100. Go figure. "Don't you have some one-size-fits-all charge to suit every occasion?" I asked. "Disturbing the peace? Interfering with official acts? Disorderly conduct? Something like that?" That just caused more grumbling. Whatever the charge ended up being, we all knew it was just a formality. They had to charge something, and I had to pay something. And it had to be done in such a way that I was set loose that night, and that would be the end of it. No court appearance, no lawyers, no scrutiny. Fine with me. I was getting snoozy. They told a big young cop named Ben to take me to my house, to the cash machine, and back. I rode in the front seat, no restraint. He waited while I ran in for my wallet. He was a polite kid, a former high school linebacker type, who was eager to do a play-by-play reenactment of the evening's chase. "I almost had you there by the sled run," he said proudly, meaning the toboggan slide.
"Oh, was that you?"
"Yep, that was darn close.
What was it you yelled? I couldn't make it out."
"Yeah," he laughs good-naturedly. "I started to yell, 'Freeze!' But that seemed like TV stuff, so I changed it to 'Stop!' in the middle, but didn't get it all out. I think I yelled, 'Freestab!'"
"Yeah," I agreed. "That's what it sounded like, 'Freestab.'
Where'd you get off to? I thought I was right behind you."
Time to lie.
Everyone in the police station had been doing this sort of excited retelling of the chase and their own role in it. In a town like this, tonight would be talked about and recounted for years to come. Guns had been drawn. County was involved. Dogs and helicopters were almost called in. Deadly words had been spoken in earnest. It turned out that the runner wasn't a real criminal, but no one knew that when it was happening. Could have been a real desperado. "You were right behind me," I told him. In truth, I had ducked behind some hedges, watched him lumber by, and went back the way he had come. "I thought you had me easy, but I just ran flat out and hid in a kid's treehouse till it was quiet." That pleased him. That was a tale he could tell.
"The sergeant aimed his gun at your head and threatened to shoot you if you moved?" asks Lisa,
setting down the pages she's just read. It's a month after these events, and we're sitting at my poolside desk on a small estate in Mexico where we are both living.
"Yeah, why?"
I look up from my laptop at the lake and mountains and rub my eyes. "Is that weird?"
"I don't know," she says. "It sounds a little theatrical."
He had to reach across himself and lift his stomach up with one hand so he could pull his gun out with the other. It wasn't that theatrical.
"Were you scared?"
"Of what?"
"Oh, I don't know. Being shot in the head?"
I shrug. "That's about the least scariest thing I can think of."
"Jesus, you're a strange man."
I shrug again.
Over the course of the few quiet months I spent living in that resort town in New England, the idea began forming in my head that there might be a need for a third book, that there were still important things left unsaid, and other things that had been said but not fully explored. When I finished the first book, Spiritual Enlightenment, The Damnedest Thing, it was a relief to have it out of my system and be done with it, but not for long. The second one, Spiritually Incorrect Enlightenment, began making its presence known, so we got that one out. Again, I felt that I had it out of my system and no more writing would be necessary, meaning, in effect, that I was done with teaching, corresponding, writing, and all things spiritual. Then, over the few months before the thing with the cops, there it was again. I didn't nurture it, but I understood from those earliest stirrings that it would survive and that a third book would need to be written. I didn't do anything to encourage it. I just let it sit there in my head to live or die on its own. The argument against doing a third book was that I was out of the teaching mode and spiritual mindset, and happily so. I was no longer communicating with anyone on these topics, and they were no longer lively in my thoughts. They were out of my system and environment, and there was nothing to suggest that I would be re-entering the world of human spirituality. Where would a third book come from? More than that, my own connection to the pre-awakened human experience was now so tenuous that I doubted a third book was even possible. The paradigm gap had grown too wide. I could no longer remember what life was like on the other side. My own experience was now so far removed from what most people called reality that there was practically no overlap. I see humans the way humans see chimps, from the same evolutionary remove. My memories of my own pre-awakened state were now as remote and impersonal as my memories of the second grade. I mentioned this gradual erosion of my dream state personhood in both books. I had been making an effort to maintain a connection, but after Incorrect, I let it go. And now, it was all but gone. One of the arguments in favor of a third book was that it would provide a framework within which I could function, a context in which I could have something to do and a reason to do it. All context is artificial, of course, but what do I care? I like being alive, and it's more fun when there's a game to play. Writing with an audience in mind is one such game. So I made the standard deal with the universe. If you want the book written, lay it out in front of me, and I'll write it. I'm not going to chase it. I'm not going to struggle to come up with stuff to write about. That would be artificial and egoic. I couldn't do it, and it wouldn't work. I knew nothing like that was being asked of me, but I wanted a clear understanding between us. If you want a third book, I'll do it. But the only way it's going to happen is if you orchestrate it. Drop it in my lap. Dealing with the universe this way is nothing new to me. We understand each other pretty well. I know how to speak, and I know how to understand what I'm being told. Patterns. Signs, subtle variations in rightness and not rightness, flow and obstruction. This is how it works. I make it sound as if the universe and I were two separate things, but it's actually the absence of that artificial distinction that I'm talking about. This is one of the things I'll be taking a closer look at in this book. This is the thing that everyone wants to hear about and tap into. Effortless functioning, direct knowing, the manifestation of abundance, health, prosperity, happiness. Understand how the universe works. Merge back into it. Learn to operate in alignment with it, and you'll blush to recall that you once thought that Albus and Obi-Wan had cool powers. There are plenty of books about how to manifest our desires from within the segregated state of human childhood. To use prayer, or wishcraft, or affirmations, or laws of attraction, to get a better house, a faster car, the perfect mate, and so on. What we'll be discussing in this book is making the transition to the integrated state of human adulthood and developing within it so that prayer, wishcraft, affirmations, and laws of attraction become superfluous, the way cheating becomes superfluous when you know the answers. Once the initial agreement with the universe about the third book was in place, other things started lining up and the project started coming into focus. For one thing, a third book just felt right. There was more to say. Important stuff. Maybe the most important stuff of all. And leaving it unsaid would have kept the project from ever feeling complete. Another thing was that the book was already dropping into my lap. I knew what the main themes would be within the first minutes of contemplating it. Also, at about the same time, I became aware of a folder full of emails I had received from a college professor, now retired, who had, I would discover, a very courageous mind and a very specialized library. He lived in Mexico, and in every email he wrote, he invited me down to visit and to avail myself of his views and his books. Most recently, he wrote about his daughter and her marriage that was on the rocks. The professor's name was Frank, and his daughter's name was Lisa. Frank had recently lost his wife, and Lisa had recently lost herself. She's one of the people helping me write the third book. She's the one who thinks I'm a strange man. All this universe talk, says Lisa after reading an early draft of the preceding few pages. It just sounds so, I don't know, I guess I don't see this perfect order that you're talking about. All I see is randomness and chaos everywhere. I don't see any real order to things. Strange that what's so simple and obvious to me can be so foreign and incomprehensible to others. When you are asleep within the dream we call reality, I say, it appears that there is chaos and randomness, as if anything could happen at any time. When you awaken within the dream state, when you open your eyes and begin to see it directly instead of imagining it from behind closed eyes, then you begin to understand how it really works, that there is a flawless, perfect intelligence governing every detail of the dreamscape of being, from the smallest to the largest. There is order, consistency, intelligence. There can be no violation or mistakes. She gives me her piercing attorney stare. And you are more attuned to this perfect universe than most people? I'm not artificially walled off from it. Most people are. As I sit there at my alfresco workspace with Lisa and two other people who are assisting me at the moment, it amazes me, as it often does, how bizarre and unlikely people are. It's as if I'm dreaming these two-dimensional characters into existence, and it's weird that I'm not doing a better job of it. They're like fleshy robots running on outdated software, unable to adapt and evolve and develop along lines that, to all appearances, are fully open to them. They possess immense stores of knowledge and full capacity for thought. They competently handle all the complexities of life, family, health, finance, career, spirituality, household, day in and day out, year after year. They are intelligent, mature, clever, kind, honest, and fairly representative in the broad strokes of people anywhere in the Western world. And yet, whenever I talk to them about the most basic and essential facts of life, all I get is dubious stares and incoherent skepticism. Growth, adulthood, energetic patterns, flow and obstruction, desire and manifestation. These should be topics in which we're all completely immersed by the age of 10, like our mother tongue. And yet, here we are, a group of supposed adults, and we can barely cobble together a serviceable lexicon of true adulthood. On the face of it, I'm not the most likely candidate for this role. I'm not the guy you look at in high school and say, "Oh yeah, this guy has spiritual enlightenment written all over him." I have qualities, the ones I need, but nothing to indicate that I would be one of the few to find the answers man has sought since the beginning of wonder. But truth and enlightenment aside, I am a well-developed and still developing human adult. I have a working knowledge of an integrated relationship with the universe that is so fluid and easy, so magical and endlessly delightful, so natural and seamless, that whenever I look at bright, capable, outwardly honest people, I have to remind myself that my reality, my safe, happy, co-creative universe, is completely alien and unknown to them. My living reality is as absurd to them as theirs is to me. What I now consider normal daily functioning would be considered by most people as something out of a B-movie, having nothing to do with real life. Even though these people I'm sitting with look like me, walk and talk like me, and appear to occupy space only a few feet away from me, we inhabit completely different and largely unrelated realms of being. We'll do a bit of a recap and a precap in the next few chapters, but for now, I want to introduce this distinction. It has nothing to do with enlightenment or truth realization. It has to do with being a naturally developed human being instead of a spiritually stunted, developmentally retarded human being. A human adult instead of a human child. Virtually everything and anything worth knowing or pursuing in terms of growth, spiritual or otherwise, is about making this transition and then continuing a lifetime's development. That's what life really is, and no one knows it. I've said that the greatest men and women who ever lived were just children on a playground from my perspective, and this is what it means. This should and seemingly could be everyone's perspective. You're reading this book, so you should certainly be assuming it could be yours. For anyone in the state of human childhood, except a human child, there should be no topic of interest other than freeing oneself from spirit-smothering emotional shackles and resuming one's right and proper life. To put our attention on anything else is to cower away from the real journey of life. Lisa, who sits with me and who will be with us throughout this book, began her unshackling recently, involuntarily, and as a complete spiritual neophyte. Bob, who we will meet later, is a long-standing spiritual expert and author who can speak knowledgeably on everything from Advaita to Zen. By the end of this book, Lisa will have completed the transition to adulthood and be continuing her development within it, while Bob will still be mired in all his books and knowledge and spiritual egohood. If, that is, they exist at all, and aren't just shadowy apparitions inhabiting my own dreamscape environment, as to which I have no opinion. Chapter 3. The Whole Truth. Well, I am certainly wiser than this man. It is only too likely that neither of us has any knowledge to boast of. But he thinks that he knows something which he does not know, whereas I am quite conscious of my ignorance. At any rate, it seems that I am wiser than he is to this small extent, that I do not think that I know what I do not know. Socrates. What do you know? Really, what, with absolute certainty, do you know? Put aside all opinions, beliefs, and theories for a moment and address this one simple question. What do you know for sure? Or as Thoreau put it, let us settle ourselves and work and wedge our feet downward through the mud and slush of opinion and prejudice and tradition and delusion and appearance, that alluvion which covers the globe, through church and state, through poetry and philosophy and religion, till we come to a hard bottom and rocks in place, which we can call reality, and say, this is, and no mistake, and then begin. In other words, let's cut the crap and figure out what we know for sure. The cogito does exactly that, and it's very simple. The question is, what do you know? The answer is, I am. All other so-called facts are really non-facts and belong in the category of consensual reality and relative truth, i.e., unreal reality and untrue truth. Cogito ergo sum is the equation that proves the fact. But first, before we go on, let's ask what else we know. What else can be said for certain? Nothing. We don't know anything else. And that's the real point of the cogito. The importance of I am isn't that it's a fact, but that it's the only fact. I am is the only thing anyone has ever known or will ever know. Everything else, all religion and philosophy and science, can never be more than dream interpretation. There is no other fact than I am. The cogito is the seed of the thought that destroys the universe. Beyond the cogito, nothing is known. Beyond the cogito, nothing can be known. Except I am. No one knows anything. No man or God can claim to know more. No God or array of gods can exist or be imagined that know more than this one thing. I am. We can't avoid letting this topic drift briefly into the Old Testament. When Moses asked God his name, God answered, I am that I am. The name God gives for himself is I am. Note that I am is unconjugatable. It allows of no variation. God doesn't say, my name is I am, but you can call me you are or he is. The cogito, the I am pronouncement, does not extend beyond one's own subjective knowing. I can say I am and know it as truth, but I can't say you are, he is, she is, we are, they are, it is, etc. I know I exist and nothing else. Understood thusly, I am, a.k.a. God, truly is the Alpha and the Omega, the entirety of being, of knowledge, of you. The cogito is the line between fantasy and reality. On one side of the cogito is a universe of beliefs and ideas and theories. To cross the line is to leave all that behind. No theory, concept, belief, opinion, or debate can have any possible basis in reality once the ramifications of the cogito have fully saturated the mind. No dialogue can take place across that line because nothing that makes sense on either side makes sense on the other. Everyone thinks they understand the cogito, but nobody does. Descartes himself didn't. If professors of philosophy truly understood the cogito, they wouldn't be professors of philosophy. Alfred North Whitehead said that all philosophy is a footnote to Plato. But all philosophy, Plato included, is rendered obsolete and irrelevant by Descartes. Nothing but the subjective I am is true. So what's the point of prattling on? There's simply nothing else to say. The cogito isn't a mere thought or an idea. It's an ego-eating virus that, if we are able to lower our defenses against it, will eventually devour all illusion. Once we know the cogito, we can begin systematically unknowing everything we think we know and unraveling the self we think we are. To understand the cogito at the surface level takes a minute or so. To let it devour you from the inside out can take years. Life is but a dream. There is no such thing as objective reality. Two cannot be proven. Nothing can be shown to exist. Time and space, love and hate, good and evil, cause and effect, are all just ideas. Anyone who says they know anything is really saying they don't know the only thing. Any assertion of truth other than I am is a confession of ignorance. The greatest religious and philosophical thoughts and ideas in the history of man contain no more truth than the bleating of sheep. The greatest books are no more authoritative than the greatest luncheon meats. No one knows anything. Disprove it for yourself. Anyone wishing to deny these statements about the meaning of the cogito need merely prove that something, anything, is true. By all means, give it a try. Smash your head against it. But it can't be done. The cogito is like a Molotov cocktail with which we can firebomb our own mind, safe in the knowledge that truth doesn't burn. This, however, is not the end of the journey of awakening. It's just the beginning.